better understand what I'd been through on my retirement odyssey, but also to provide information that you, the listener, might be able to benefit from. Here's what I learned. We are the lucky ones. As I've mentioned, many Americans haven't saved at all, or haven't saved enough. The most common reason for that is, predictably, not having enough left over in the paycheck to put much aside. Remember that National Institute on Retirement Security study that showed 45% of households have no retirement accounts at all? It also found an enormous income split between the savers and the save-nots. Households that do have retirement accounts have more than 2.4 times the annual income of those that don't. A median income of $86,235 compared with $35,509. So nearly 9 in 10 families in the top fifth of income had retirement savings in 2013, and fewer than 1 in 10 in the bottom fifth did. There's an age difference, too, according to the group. While the typical working-class household has $2,500 in retirement account assets, those closer to retirement age, 55 to 64, have an average of $14,500. Still not enough by a long shot. In that older group, 62% have retirement savings of less than 1 year of income, which won't get anyone very far. Of course, those are averages that lump in the grasshoppers with the ants, those people who have saved nothing with those who are saving well. Averages that include half of those in it at zero will naturally end up very low. But what about the average savings among those who have been putting something away? Still not great. The Economic Policy Institute, a progressive think tank in Washington, found that the median retirement savings figure among families with retirement accounts is $60,000. With numbers like that, no wonder the Center for Retirement Research at Boston College has warned that more than half of American households won't have enough retirement income to maintain the standard of living from their working years. Americans aren't doing so well, compared with those in other nations either. Despite our high per capita income, the United States ranks 14th in retirement security globally, according to Natixis Global Asset Management, which compares 150 countries on factors like material well-being, healthcare, and quality of life. It's a mess. Or as the satirists at The Onion put it, Nazi treasure hunters following more realistic retirement plan than 86% of country. We, you, me, the rest of us, can do better. For many Americans, retirement used to rest on three legs like a stool. On savings, on Social Security, and on pensions. A big part of the current problem comes down to the squeeze on pensions across the country. In 1975, nearly half of private, non-farm wage and salary workers took part in the classic defined benefit pension plan. By 2004, that number had ducked under 17%. The loss of pensions removes one of the legs of the stool and makes saving for retirement more dependent on a wage earner's decision to put money away in a retirement savings account and to keep contributing. A voluntary act, and one that is in competition with many other demands on our cash. Pensions don't make people as much money as a well-funded, well-invested 401k or IRA can, but they can provide a dependable income in retirement. While saving money for retirement has become more important, many of us don't feel that we know what to do or how to do it. Even among those who do plan, honest people tend to admit I, don't really know what they are doing. According to a 2016 survey from the Federal Reserve, nearly one half of non-retirees with retirement accounts admitted that they were not confident, or only slightly confident, about being able to make good investment decisions. So don't feel like a dope. Half of us don't think we know what we're doing. We're right. most Americans really don't know that much about money. The FINRA Investment Education Foundation has been studying our money sense for years, and the results don't look great. Part of its work involves a 5-question quiz, with a bonus, that it gives to more than 25,000 people. Most Americans get only about half the answers right. The national average is 3.16. Those in Montana did much better, with a score of 3.78, while my home state of Texas came in with a low, low 2.81. The trend is not good. Since FINRA started asking the questions in 2009, the percentage of right answers has dropped from 42% in 2009 to 39% in 2012 to 37% in 2015. The question with the fewest right answers, just 28% nationwide, asks how bond prices move compared with rising interest rates. They tend to drop. What's worse, we tend to think we know more about money than we actually do. FINRA surveys show that more than 3/4 of people they asked to assess their own financial knowledge gave themselves a nice, high score, 5 to 7 on a 7-point scale. While their actual financial knowledge was dropping from 2009 to 2015, their self-confidence was growing, with high self-assessments up from 67% in 2009. This plays out pretty clearly in FINRA surveys. Of the 42% of Americans who gave themselves the highest score on dealing with day-to-day financial matters, like tracking their expenses and managing bank accounts and credit cards, nearly a third made expensive credit card mistakes, such as paying only the minimum amount due, which builds up interest debt, getting stuck with late fees, and using cards for cash advances. More than 1 in 10 of the people giving themselves the highest marks nonetheless overdrew their checking accounts. So what we have here, nationally, is the financial version of what social scientists call the Dunning-Kruger effect, which tells us that people who are not competent tend to have greater confidence in their abilities than people who are good at what they do. As David Dunning and Justin Kruger put it in a paper, not only do they reach erroneous conclusions and make unfortunate choices, but their incompetence robs them of the ability to realize it. Sounds familiar. We see this kind of aggressive ignorance all around us. And no, I am not making a political comment here, at least explicitly. You could consider it a subtweet, though. In any case, there's no financial overconfidence in our little house, I can tell you that. I took the FINRA quiz. It asks things like, suppose you have $100 in a savings account earning 2% interest a year. After 5 years, how much would you have? It then offers a range of answers. More than $102, or exactly $102, or less than $102. This is about compound interest, I thought, and picked more than $102, though I would have broken a couple of pencils before coming up with exactly how much the account would have in it after 5 years, $110.41. As for the question, true or false, buying a single company's stock usually provides a safer return than a stock mutual fund. Well, the value of baskets of funds over stock picking in the long term is such a basic fact of financial life that even I understand it. And you should too. More on that later. Much more. I ended up getting all 6 right, which made me feel great. I asked Jean if she wanted to take the test. Sure, she said. Oh, Jean groused when I sent her the link. I don't like numbers. Which is funny, since she's the one running our bills and initiating some of our bigger decisions in the financial world. Still, she groaned as she took the quiz. Repeatedly. It's not that long a quiz. But she sighed at each question and said, I'm going to do really badly. She missed the bond question, but got 3 right, coming in at the national average and beating out half of Americans. Here we go. The basics. We, and I mean the big we here, as in all of us, don't have to remain ignorant about money. We can learn. The easiest way to save is the way we did it, through an employer-based savings plan known as a 401k. Most retirement saving still takes place at work. There's much to be said for shunting dollars automatically from your paycheck into an account that you don't have to think about. You don't have to be strong, don't have to be good. You just have to stay employed. And many employers kick in a little extra to boost what you are saving, which is an even greater incentive for you to put money away. Free stuff. Along with the automatic savings involved with 401k plans, the additional beauty of them is this. You don't pay taxes on the money you put in during the years you are building your savings. You get taxed only when you take the money out again. Since most people can expect to be in a somewhat lower tax bracket after they are not drawing a regular paycheck, the taxes on the money you take out at retirement are smaller. There can be expensive penalties, however, if you pull money out early. There is another kind of 401k offered by many employers that's known as a Roth 401k. The main difference between a plain vanilla 401k and a Roth plan is that you pay the taxes up front, as the money goes into the savings plan, and so the money coming out at the other end is tax-free. The Roth is a popular option for younger employees whose income and tax rate may be relatively low. They expect to be paying a higher tax rate down the line, so want to take the smaller sting up front. It's also a tactic used by people who are trying to set up an inheritance plan so survivors won't be burdened with income taxes. If your employer offers both, you can split your contributions between a traditional 401k and a Roth. You can find online calculators that help determine whether a traditional or a Roth is better for you at sites like Betterment.com. So employer-sponsored savings plans are great. But while that kind of employment used to be the way of the American economy, not everyone has access to a plan these days. A study by the Pew Charitable Trusts found that 58% of workers today have access to a savings plan sponsored by their employer. Because not everyone who could use the plans does, an even smaller percentage of workers, just 49%, takes advantage of them. The shifting world of employment plays a part. Many of us are working differently than our parents did. Maybe you are self-employed or working for a small company that doesn't go to the trouble and expense to set one up. That's pretty common. Just 22% of companies with fewer than 10 employees have access to a workplace retirement plan. At companies with at least 500 employees, it's 74%. A nation divided in so many ways is also divided when it comes to retirement savings. The folks at Pew found that participation in plans varied because of factors like geography, income level, and race. In Wisconsin, 61% of workers have access to an employer-based pension or retirement savings plan. In Florida, the figure is just 38%. Workers in New England and the Midwest are likelier to take part than those in the South and West. As for income level, only a third of workers making less than $25,000 a year have access to one. For people making more than $100,000, it's 3 out of 4. And Hispanic workers are 25% less likely than non-Hispanic workers to have access to a plan. So, how do you save if your employer doesn't help you save? The main retirement savings plan for self-employed people and those who don't like their employer's 401k plan, some companies offer a limited range of investment options, is the IRA, Individual Retirement Account. You set it up through financial institutions like banks, mutual fund companies, and brokerage firms. As with 401k plans, they come in two flavors, traditional and Roth, with the same differences in tax treatment. That is, you can make contributions to traditional IRAs tax-free and pay the taxes during retirement, presumably at a lower tax rate than during your working life. With the Roth IRA, you pay the taxes up front and make the withdrawals tax-free later. IRA plans have contribution limits set by Congress. For 2017, the limit for either kind of IRA plan is $5,500, though people older than 50 have a higher catch-up limit of $6,500. You can have both a 401k and an IRA, but you might not be able to deduct all your contribution if you have both. If you need to tap either a 401k or an IRA, you will find that the money is expensive. Pulling out funds before the age of 59 and a half will bring on a 10% penalty, along with whatever taxes you have to pay on the money. There are also penalties if you don't take out enough of your money once you pass 70 and a half. There is a required minimum distribution. Small business owners and freelancers can also take part in what are known as Simplified Employee Pension, SEP, IRAs. In recent years, other savings plans have emerged. Some states have retirement programs of their own, including California, Connecticut, and Maryland, according to the Georgetown University Center for Retirement Initiatives. Illinois has introduced the Secure Choice Savings Program for small businesses, with the pilot program scheduled to begin in 2018. Even if your employer does offer a 401k plan, it's worth checking to see what fees might be hidden in the plan. I looked at a plan being offered to our younger son through his employer. He would be charged a 3% annual third-party administrative service fee and a 1.5% annual asset charge. So these folks were going to take 4.5% of his 401k deposits, not counting additional fees that he'd be paying if he signed up for so-called advisory services that cost $25 annually and an additional 0.65% of assets. That's obscene. The company Brightscope, which rates 401k plans, says that large plans with more than $100 million in assets almost uniformly have fees below 1%. Smaller plans tend to have higher fees, since their operational costs are higher. But the company warns that paying north of 2% a year in fees makes investing prohibitively expensive and eats a big hole in participant retirement balances, regardless of the services that are offered at that fee level. I suggested to my son that unless the employer is offering a very big match to his contribution, he might do better to start with a personal IRA with automatic payroll deductions. Some funds now. Common investment vehicles. Whether you have a 401k or an IRA or some other form of retirement plan, you'll be making choices among many kinds of investments. Most common are the mutual funds, which spread your buying power by giving you a portion of a more diversified package of investments than you could afford if you had to buy each stock or bond in the fund. The largest group of mutual funds are equity funds, made up of stocks, that is, shares in companies. Within the world of stock funds, some focus on big companies, known as large cap, for large capitalization, with at least $5 billion in market value. Others focus on small ones, small cap, which generally have a market value of less than $2 billion. There are also funds focusing on what's in between, known as the mid-cap stocks, and myriad others, including some that give you the opportunity to invest in foreign stocks. Some funds focus on so-called growth stocks, which appear to be on the rise. Companies in hot technologies like renewable energy and biotech, for example. Others focus on what are called value stocks, which are seen as trading below what they are actually worth. And many, many funds blend the categories. Generally, buying into the stock market is the way to make money in the long term. Going beyond the world of stocks, there are funds based on bonds, debt of businesses or governments, which tend to not provide as much investment growth over time, but do tend to be more stable, with a lower risk of loss through market ups and downs. On the even more financially conservative end of the spectrum are money market funds, which are built from extremely stable investments like U.S. Treasury bills. Because nothing is simple in this world, there are also all kinds of funds that blend stocks, bonds, and other investments as well. What's the right balance between stocks, bonds, and money market funds? It depends on how old you are. Investment advisors generally suggest being heavy into stocks early in life and shifting more toward bonds as retirement nears, when a downturn could leave you substantially less to live on. There's an old rule of thumb for asset allocation. Subtract your age from 100, and the resulting number is the percentage of your investments you should have in stocks. Because people live longer than they used to, and because investments like treasury bonds don't pay as much as they used to, rule of thumb watchers have revised the number to subtract from to 110 or even 120. Let's go back to the discussion I had with the guy from Vanguard about stock funds versus bonds. He told me that I should, at my age, have about 35% of my investments in bonds and about 65% in stocks. That was a little aggressive on Vanguard's part, compared with the revised rule of thumb. But they were working with my own questionnaire that said I was willing to take on a fair amount of risk. If you want to balance your portfolio to include more bonds and fewer stocks as you get closer to retirement, there are funds that adjust the balance automatically. These are called target date funds, or TDFs. You decide when you think you'll be retiring. There's that big question again. And pick a fund with a matching date. Not only are there different kinds of investments such as stocks and bonds, there are also different kinds of funds you can use to invest in those stocks and bonds. The most important difference, actively managed funds versus index funds. In a managed fund, financial people do research and figure out what stocks, bonds, and other instruments should be in their mix of investments and buy and sell them. The idea is that a smart manager will help you beat the market and make more money. A debatable proposition, as we'll see. In any case, that management infrastructure costs money, and you, the investor, pay it in the fund's fees. You can expect to pay 1 to 1.5% of your investment each year for these funds. It may not sound like much, but it adds up. Index funds were created partly in reaction to the relatively high fees of managed funds. They are based on a simple grouping of stocks. Say, all the companies in the popular S&P 500. We'll be talking a lot more about index funds later in this chapter, but for the moment, know that they generally cost less than 1% per year and can cost just 0.03%. There's another kind of fund out there that you should know about for this primer, an exchange-traded fund, or ETF. An ETF looks like a mutual fund in a lot of ways, but can be traded like a stock, so they're easier to get in and out of than mutual funds. ETFs can combine stocks, bonds, and other financial instruments, and a lot of them are created as index funds. The best known of these is the SPDR, which goes by the symbol SP. ETFs have been around since the early 1990s, but boomed in the 2000s with some $3 trillion in assets worldwide. Now, the ability to easily trade ETFs goes against my personal set-it-and-forget-it philosophy, but they are enormously popular. And who am I to argue with people who, at least, are saving? What an alphabet soup this all is. And I haven't even mentioned REITs, real estate investment trusts. And I won't. There's more. For example, annuities, which are an investment, often a form of insurance that is designed to pay out a certain amount of money each year. Essentially, you are paying for peace of mind. They can be complex, but they can also be useful under some circumstances, and a deep dive into what they do is beyond the scope of this book. But I will give an example showing how they can serve as an add-on to your retirement plan. If you've saved plenty, you can take a largish chunk out of your 401k and roll it into what is known as an immediate annuity, essentially a contract from an insurance company to begin paying you a set amount based on the money you have put down. That sets up a system to pay you a certain amount a year, no matter what happens to the market. With the annuity, your risk has been reduced. The money won't run out, as could happen with a drawn-down IRA if you live to be a Methuselah age. And that investment, at least, won't lose value if the market takes a hit. There are plenty of non-financial investments as well. Things we buy thinking they will go up in value, like collectibles, art, even comic books. If you've got the cash and a gift for spotting a vintage Gibson Les Paul in a pawn shop or a Richard Diebenkorn painting on the wall at Goodwill, go ahead and indulge. I have a friend who paid his kids' college tuitions from the profits he made selling indigenous art objects from around the world. For the rest of us, though, that kind of investment is a risky business. Art, as an investment, is tricky. In our house, we have two large canvases. One shows Venice by day, and the other, Paris at dusk. The Paris painting is a view of Place Pigalle, the rain-washed streets, filled with pedestrians and horse-drawn carriages, reflect the light pouring from the shops and clubs. The Venice one, by contrast, shows a pale sky over a drowsy assortment of boats sitting moored just beyond Piazza San Marco. Those big paintings had hung in my parents' house. Dad and Mom bought them on their honeymoon in New Orleans. I figure they found them in one of those great old shops on Royal Street. For years, the name on the paintings was unknown to me. A. De Vitti. When my parents sold the house I grew up in and asked if any of us kids wanted anything from the old place, I asked for Paris and Venice. They are treasures, or at least so says Dad. At various times when he's been worried about our financial squeezes, he has suggested we sell the paintings. They're probably worth a couple of $100,000 now, he'd say. I'd ask for the paintings because I loved them. They reminded me of home. We had no interest in starting an art collection. We have some pieces we like, including works by artist friends that we bought in galleries, and a painting of a tiger that Jean's dad painted on boards joined at a 90-degree angle so that it could hang in the corner of a room. But no overarching personal aesthetic guides us. Some of our friends' homes look like galleries. Our homes have looked like us, comfortable and familiar, if a bit of a mess. And our art, we've always been pretty sure, isn't valuable. Dad was insistent, though, that Paris and Venice would set us on our feet financially. So I did some research and discovered that works by De Vitti, there are two generations, father and son, and there are thousands of paintings out there, including forgeries, are not highly valued today. Their paintings fetch anywhere from a few $100 to $1,500. Not worth selling, in other words. And that's fine. I love looking at them. The research helped me confirm, for my own sake, that I don't come from a line of savvy art collectors. There's another problem with collecting. Fraud. The main reason I know that works by the abstract painter Richard Diebenkorn are valuable is that in 2001, I worked with another reporter, Judith H. Dobrzynski, on stories about a scam involving crooked bidding on eBay. The ring of art fraudsters made it look like an auction for what appeared to be a Diebenkorn was legitimate and drove up the price on a single painting to $135,805. Bogus artworks from the crew, who also auctioned works purported to be created by Edward Hopper, Alberto Giacometti, and Clifford Still, cost buyers $450,000. So caveat emptor and all that. Getting to know yourself and your tolerance for financial risk. There's still more to say about investing, so much more, but it's a start. If this is an intellectual battle, consider yourself lightly armed. At the end of this chapter, I'll be saying more about the simplest way through the maze, but with these basics, you are at least ready to learn more, or to talk with a financial advisor to figure out your next moves. I've got a lot more to say about investment advisors as well, in the next chapter. Even before you put money into investments, though, it's best to know yourself. What kind of investor are you? How much risk can you tolerate? Risk is part of every investment decision. Where you strike the balance between stocks and bonds in your own investment portfolio has a lot to do with your attitude about risk. The questionnaire I filled out for the Vanguard Retirement Evaluation tried to get at my attitudes toward risk, but in a fairly superficial way. Ron Lieber, who writes about personal finance for the New York Times, wrote a great column about quizzes that help you understand your willingness to take on financial risk. He pointed people to quizzes they could take at websites like riskprofiling.com and riskalyze.com, as well as tests at betterment.com, wealthfront.com, and finmason.com. It's important to know your risk tolerance, he explained, because finding the kinds of investments that fit your emotional makeup can help you avoid making market mistakes. He said, too many people don't know their tolerance well enough and take on too much risk. This can result in getting greedy and buying more investments while stock prices are high and selling when stocks have plunged, thus locking in losses. The result of such moves is too often a portfolio that earns many percentage points less over the years than it may have if you had just left things alone. If you're going to meet your financial goals and be able to deal with emergencies, you're going to have to take some financial risks with your investments. Knowing how much you'll be comfortable with can help you reach your goals. I took one of the tests, a one-pager based on research by Ruth Litton at Virginia Tech and John Grable at the University of Georgia. It said, there are no right or wrong answers. Just have fun. The quiz asked 13 questions, including this one. In addition to whatever you own, you have been given $2,000. You are now asked to choose between a sure loss of $500 or a 50% chance to lose $1,000 and a 50% chance to lose nothing. The thing made my palms sweat a little, but at least it didn't take long. And when I was done, it gave me a number. My score was 24. Average moderate tolerance for risk. A little lower than I expected, but it probably wasn't far wrong. I asked Jean to take the test, and she scored 22, which is considered a below average tolerance for risk, which we kind of knew already. The results page led to another page that listed investments grouped by their relative risks and rewards. The high-risk category included investments like aggressive growth funds and cheap, volatile penny stocks and precious metals funds. In the moderate range were things like the stock index funds that make up most of our 401k. At the very bottom of the scale were the investment equivalents of stuffing money in the mattress, certificates of deposit and savings accounts. If we were just starting out, tests like this could possibly help us figure out what kinds of investments best suited us, maybe with the help of a kindly financial professional. The tests can be abused, however, by brokers, as the financial planner and New York Times columnist Carl Richards has written, to plug investors into a prepackaged blend of mutual funds without really considering the specifics of annoying, messy things like values and goals. In other words, it's a lazy way of making a basic diagnosis and then writing you a prescription. Quizzes take you only so far, especially when our attitudes can be shaped by events. In hot markets, people love risk. If it looks like it's hard to lose, we tell ourselves, go big or go home. When markets go south, we become risk averse. You can gain some insight into the kind of investment strategy you'd like by thinking about the kinds of risk you take in your own life. In my personal life, I've taken plenty of risks, but I don't consider myself foolhardy. I have gone skydiving, but just once in my 20s. That was enough. For work, I've done things like riding in military helicopters with open cargo doors into disaster areas, and herding cattle away from Hurricane Harvey's floodwaters in a two-seater helicopter with a 22-year-old daredevil. As we were about to climb in for that wild ride, the young man's father soberly asked, "Ryan, did you get him to sign the waiver?" "I've experienced zero gravity in a NASA plane and worn a metal suit while being zapped with a million volts from a big Tesla coil. But I didn't do anything I thought was truly unsafe, even the million volts thing. Just Google Faraday cage, and you'll see why. I've been in greater danger just driving on icy streets to my morning commuter train." Evaluating risk is something that each of us does every day, though we might not think of it as such. We decide whether to eat healthy food and try to make sense of the newspaper stories about whether coffee is good or bad for you, and then probably drink coffee anyway. Part of our tolerance for risk comes from how we were raised. I grew up in the distant past, before the emergence of overanxious parenting. There's no doubt our folks loved us, but they weren't what you'd call fretful. Trucks that sprayed DDT lumbered through the streets of Galveston on summer nights. We ran behind the trucks to feel the cooling mist from the sprayer and to breathe in the weird Swedish fog. We survived. DDT is far tougher on bugs and birds' eggs than on people. But I'd have never let my own kids do it. That was not our only toxic exposure. Natural oil seepage from the floor of the Gulf of Mexico and oil shipping sent hard little tar balls onto Galveston's beaches. After the BP oil disaster in 2010, tar balls were a source of anger and worry for coastal communities and tourist parents. When I was a kid, our parents simply pointed at tar balls and said, "Don't eat them." We kept some turpentine by the back door to wash the gunk off our feet when we came back to the house, because that stuff was never going to come off the terrazzo. For all the environmental damage associated with disasters like the Deepwater Horizon oil spill, my parents, apparently, were right about tar balls. Studies suggest the risk from mere skin exposure is low. The turpentine might not have been a great idea, though. These days, I have to think through questions of risk more than most people, because I learn about new ones all the time as a science reporter. Take plastics. In The Graduate, they were the future. Now, they are a big problem for the planet. Tiny shredded bits of the stuff can be found in the world's oceans and other bodies of water. People throw away trash, and much of it ends up deteriorating in the sea. Not just plastic bags and bottles, but also toys, and even the tiny microbeads that have been used in some exfoliants, shampoos, and cosmetics. There are even shredded plastic fibers that come from washing clothes made with some blends of polyester. Anyway, this stuff is pretty much everywhere now, and the pieces of plastic attract nasty chemicals like PCBs. Tiny marine animals and fish eat the plastic, which means that by the time you work across the marine food web and up the food chain, creatures that eat a lot of fish, like herons, end up having a lot of plastic in their gullets, and potentially the toxins too. The science is still being worked out, but basically, this means that the fish that's supposed to be healthy for you also contains new additional risks. As with mercury in tuna, the question of whether to eat fish in light of ocean plastics is a risk-balancing act. So what do I do about fish? I eat it. I'm a product of my upbringing. By nature, I'm not a nervous person, and I balance the risks against the possible rewards. I don't change much of my behavior if the extent of the problem is still poorly understood. Gulf Coast oysters were a big part of my childhood, as were those Gulf brown shrimp as big as my fist. We can't eliminate all risks from our lives, and most foods are a mixture of upside and downside. And so I tend to eat what makes me happy, and not to eat too much of any of it. That doesn't mean I'm stupid about risk. I did stop smoking. There's nothing good about using tobacco, except that it made me feel good, and I miss it so much. But I also still grill meat, which may increase my risk of cancer slightly. Eating meat entails other risks, including an elevated risk of heart disease. I eat less of it than I used to, both for my health and for environmental reasons, and, so far as I can tell, the health benefits of eating a hunk of salmon still outweigh the risks of grilling it. Still, I floss every night. I didn't always, but I needed periodontal surgery in my late 20s and started flossing soon after that. Never stopped, and never had the problem again. Recent much-hyped research suggests that the benefits of flossing are not proven. Like a lot of people who have looked at the evidence, I don't buy it. Or, as I put it in a passionate tweet, I don't care what the small, poorly done studies don't prove. I'm flossing, baby, now and forever. What does all this mean about how I invest? By standard measures, as the Vanguard guy told me, I have stayed in stocks to a greater extent longer than I probably should have. Partly, of course, that's because I wasn't paying attention and hadn't changed the mix much since I bought into my current funds when I started out at Newsweek, and then the Times. But it also means that I'm inclined to continue staying heavily invested in stocks a while longer. After the article about our retirement plans came out, several people wrote to warn me about bonds. With interest rates at historic lows, they pointed out, bonds aren't actually a great investment right now, and their protective value might be overstated by conventional wisdom. And when was I actually going to retire? If I kept working until 70, it might make sense to stomach a greater amount of risk until I was closer to the send-off. I may have come to planning late in the game, but if my dad is any indication, I've got a good 20 years or more left. I'm healthier at this age than my dad was, thanks to things like getting more exercise, having quit smoking earlier in life, and eating less barbecue. So I'm putting off that rebalancing for a while longer, because, as far as I can tell, I've got longer. And you probably do too. So, how about you? Do you floss? Would you jump out of an airplane? How does any of this translate into your own personal tolerance for risk, especially when it comes to investing? My fretting about all this and my worry that I might be making irrational choices puts me in good company. In his fine book, Your Money in Your Brain, the Wall Street Journal Intelligent Investor columnist Jason Zweig told the story of Harry M. Markowitz, who developed a theory of portfolio selection that balanced risk and return so effectively that it won him the Nobel Memorial Prize in Economic Sciences. But Markowitz, in his investing life, found that he couldn't follow his own plan. Zweig quoted him as saying, "I should have computed the historical covariances of the asset classes and drawn an efficient frontier. Instead, I visualized my grief if the stock market went way up and I wasn't in it, or if it went way down and I was completely in it. My intention was to minimize my future regret, so I split my contributions 50-50 between bonds and equities. If a certified genius couldn't do it, I'm not going to feel as bad about myself." Aging people, changing investment strategies. As I mentioned earlier, your investment needs to change as you age. Planning for retirement in your 20s and 30s is largely all about getting started with a savings plan and building those funds aggressively. One strategy? Start small, with a contribution that is just a few percent of your income. Preferably, you'd want to channel enough into an investment account to make sure that you take advantage of any match that your employer provides, if there is one. Many employers will match a portion of your contribution up to, say, 5% of your income. Don't give up free money. Once you've started, you can increase your contribution by 1 percentage point a year. Not enough to hurt, but enough to be putting away 10% or more of your income before long. At this writing, the federal government allows you to put as much as $18,000 into retirement accounts each year. By your 50s, it's more about disentangling yourself from debt and figuring out what your retirement income might look like and taking the steps you can to address it. After you reach the age of 50, the federal government allows a $6,000 bump up to the maximum contribution you can make to a 401k, which means your total can be as much as $24,000. But you can put money into IRAs as well. And if you haven't put away savings by your 50s, you need to push yourself to address that problem while you still can. Carrie Schwab Pomerantz, the co-author of the Charles Schwab Guide to Finances After 50, writes that if you reach your sixth decade and haven't started saving yet, you'll need to siphon off at least 40% of your income each year until retirement to catch up. By your 60s, it's about making sure that your mix of assets is balanced in a way to protect you from market volatility during the years you'll be drawing money out of your plans. And more, we're being advised to expect that period of drawing down these funds to be longer than we'd expected. But then what? The biggest change in the world of retirement is that Americans are living longer. According to the Society of Actuaries, a 65-year-old man can expect to live, on average, to 85.8. A woman will live longer still, 87.8 years. In 2000, life expectancy at 65 was 84.6 for men and 86.4 for women. Longer life is good. It sure beats the alternative. But financially speaking, it introduces complications. For one thing, it puts pressure on the Social Security program, which was designed for an America with a shorter lifespan. The program now has to pay out benefits to people who will be spending more of their lives in retirement. It was also designed for families that had more children than we have today, so that built-in assumptions called for more wage earners putting money into the system. A 2010 report from the Social Security Administration suggested that by 2035, taxes will be enough to pay for only 75% of scheduled benefits. For people like you and me, those additional years spent in retirement could mean needing a greater amount of money in the old retirement account. Remember the question from Vanguard about how long I expected to live? So that calls for more retirement planning than our parents' generations needed, especially since more of that older generation had jobs with decent pensions. A 401k, or an IRA, offers you the opportunity to earn more than you might have from a straight pension. But the obligation and risk are on you to build that fortune through perseverance and smart investing. Those pensions kept going as long as the former employee kept breathing. That trend has led many employers that provide pensions to their employees to now offer retirees a lump sum. If you have worked for an employer that provides a pension, you will probably hear from them with the prospect of being paid a large chunk all at once. These really took off after the Great Recession and saved employers from the obligation of a lifetime payout. They get to dump you off their pension plan, and you get money up front. The lump is usually big and attractive. The Government Accountability Office found 22 plan sponsors that offered lump sum windows in 2012, along with 498,000 employees involved, and lump sums totaling $9.25 billion. If you think you might not need the pension to live on, you can invest the lump sum and pass it on to the kids. But if you'll need the money throughout your old age, holding on to the pension is the better idea. Interlude. I try to become a financial genius by reading a shelf of books. Even though I don't generally like personal finance books, particularly the ones that are teachy and preachy, and that try to make their rather pedestrian advice sound like a secret code for success. As you'll see, I found something to like in almost all these books, but they are not enough. For real insight into how people deal with money, for powerful warnings and examples that stick with me, I turn to novels. You might have noticed that I've been quoting more Dickens and Trollope than Dave Ramsey or Susie Orman. The novelists don't tell us how to properly balance our portfolios, but they do tell us how to balance our lives. Many of the financial guides are trying to sell us something. The best novels teach us something. Why, yes, I did major in liberal arts in college. What's your point? Take it from Friedrich Engels, no slouch in the economics realm. In a letter describing Balzac's La Comédie Humaine, Engels said, thanks to that work, with its detailed description of French society down to its economic details, I have learned more than from all the professed historians, economists, and statisticians of the period together. I have read some Balzac. I have tried to read Engels. I know who I'd rather have with me at the beach. So as I have worked my way through the finance books, I have also read some amazing novels. I get most of my reading done using audiobooks during my morning run and my commute. Some of our greatest writers have obsessed over money. It's getting and spending, and what the want of it does to our lives. When Jane Austen's characters talk about being distressed for money, you know exactly what she means. Dickens shows us the pain of grinding poverty and the frippery that can come with wealth and position. He gives us literature's famously optimistic spendthrift, Wilkins Micawber, of the timeless David Copperfield. This book opens with one of Micawber's great and simple statements about money. Annual income, £20. Annual expenditure, £19, 19 and 6. Result, happiness. Annual income, £20. Annual expenditure, £20, 0 and 6. Result, misery. He's talking about a difference of just sixpence each year between success and failure. That's hyperbole. But the underlying logic is unshakable. Spend more than you take in, and you're headed for trouble. Like Hamlet's Polonius, however, Micawber is the least likely character to look to for advice. He ends up in debtor's prison in the course of the novel, though he eternally believes that something will turn up and deliver him and his family from penury. In the 1935 film based on the novel, you see how W.C. Fields captured that old scoundrel Micawber brilliantly. Anthony Trollope, too, gives us many characters who fall into trouble with spending and debt. Most spectacularly, his George Vavasor, a young man in Can You Forgive Her? Born a gentleman and once elected to Parliament, he is feckless, and his need for money drives him to evil. He even attempts to kill his rival for a well-heeled woman's affections. You don't have to go back 150 years to find good writing about money, though. Just look at the delightful mess Sue Townsend describes in Adrian Mole and the Weapons of Mass Destruction, the sixth book in her series of hilarious novels about a young man's progress in the world. The 2004 novel is about the continuing misadventures of Adrian Mole. On the world stage is the epic fiasco of the war in Iraq, which Adrian enthusiastically supported. On a private level, it is the fiasco of his finances. A decided lack of planning and foresight underlies each part of the story, of course. Adrian has fallen into ruinous debt, spending money on things like a fancy apartment and a high-tech refrigerator that tells him when the food inside has reached its sell-by date. A friend who is a financial advisor tries to talk Adrian into more sensible, frugal ways, even quoting good old Micawber. And when Adrian asks him what he can do, the friend, Parvez, gives it to him straight. You could start by living in the world me and Fatima live in. I don't earn much, so we live in a small house, and we ain't got a talking fridge. Ours just sits under the worktop and keeps its gob shut. You can't afford a lifestyle, Molly. Only a life. The first time I read that, it gave me chills, and not just because I recognized the bit of Adrian Mole in me. That's what great novels do. They help us experience the lives of others and get to know ourselves better in the process. Can Robert Kiyosaki, Rich Dad, Poor Dad, do that? In any case, I did take on a shelf of personal finance books, both to learn more about finance and to serve you, my patient listener. To be honest, I selected a pretty small shelf. Maybe it's an end table. Anyone embarking on a course of reading in personal finance should probably start with The Only Investment Guide You'll Ever Need by Andrew Tobias. It first came out in 1978, and Tobias has brought out new editions regularly ever since. This book is a gem. Commonsensical, conversational, and fun. He urges frugality in a thousand ways because of a fundamental point. Money saved is more valuable than money earned. Tobias put it this way. Every nickel you earn has already been pretty costly, because it has come to you after taxes, and everything else that makes the gross income number on your tax return so much bigger than the net. Every nickel you spend has already been through the withholding ringer. It is a precious thing. Tobias writes that Benjamin Franklin had it only half right, that while a penny saved is a penny earned, the updated adage would read, a penny saved is two pennies earned, or nearly so. So he tells us to buy in bulk and get discounts and weatherize our homes and other actions that can save those earned pennies. He tells us that the wealthy businessman, Charles Revson, bought Cepacol mouthwash by the case, saving money on the discount and beating inflation, using this year's mouthwash at last year's price. Buy your wines by the case, he said. 10% off a $10 bottle of wine, he wrote, would put about $400 extra in the bank account by the end of the year. What he called a chicken-hearted way to play commodities. All these savings add up. His first edition has the Cepacol story in it. It was written before the spread of big-box stores like Walmart and Costco, with their discounts on mountainous packages of toilet paper and other necessities. The world caught up with Tobias. In his 2016 edition, he points out that the 1978 version of the book came out before the existence of 401k plans, adjustable-rate mortgages, and the Internet. Even with all the change in the intervening years, he wrote, the basics of personal finance haven't changed. They never do. Phew, I thought. His message, true to his word, is simple and entertainingly delivered. Live within your means. Save a lot. Invest over the long haul. Savings is only the beginning. This broad guide has tips on patient investing, sensible tax planning, and other topics. Even so, Tobias lets you know that he's a little embarrassed by the immodest title, which was the publisher's idea. In a weak moment I went along, and that it's the only guide you'll need, mainly because so many of the other guides are so awful. He doesn't promise to make the reader rich, but he promises not to lead you on a chase for get-rich-quick schemes. Even more important, he dissects what's wrong with most other guides. The ones that hold out the promise of riches are frauds. The ones that deal with strategies in commodities or gold are too narrow. They tell you how you might play a particular game, but not whether to be playing the game at all. The ones that are encyclopedic, with a chapter on everything, leave you pretty much where you were to begin with, trying to choose from a myriad of competing alternatives. How seductive are the ideas that Tobias gives us? Taking all my newly learned financial experience, I decided to do one new thing. To buy my next bottles of wine by the case. For the last year or so, I've been drinking a glass of wine a night before bed. It's good for maintaining a healthy cholesterol level. It helps me get to sleep, and it tastes good. It makes me feel pretty good, too. One glass doesn't give me much of a buzz, but that's not really the point of drinking at this stage of my life, by which I mean I'm Not in college anymore. What do I buy? Mainly Italian reds. Mainly Chianti, thanks to a 6-month study abroad program in